to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday, the 10th of January, 2022, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. It is the first Real Britannia of the year. This series has actually been going for quite a few years now, I believe, 3 or 4 years maybe. And we're looking forward to 2022. And of course, we are here today with Max Musson from Western Spring to discuss the past week's news and what's going on in Britain, the sort of news that is going to be important to nationalists. So, Max, how are you doing? Happy New Year to you, sir. I trust you had a good couple of weeks off. Did you have a good festive period?
Yes, I did. And I'm feeling quite sort of bullish about the new year. I think that this is the year where we're going to finally throw off the last vestiges of COVID-19. Now that Omicron has come along and has been shown to be only very, very marginally more infectious and dangerous than the flu used to be. And so perhaps we can all stop worrying about it so much now and just get on with life, and most importantly, get on with building a nationalist movement in the hope of saving our country and saving our nation.
Well, I think you're right there, Max. I think we may be reaching the end of the COVID-19 scares with Omicron. It's not just us that are saying this now in the alternative media. There are scientists that are saying this. It was in the Daily Mail over the weekend, and that will give us a chance to talk about some other news as well. We do have lots of things happening over here in Britain at the moment, and one of the main ones that's being talked about is this knighthood of Tony Blair. I never would have thought Tony Blair would have been put forward for a knighthood, and what it has done is it has spurred lots of people on to sign a petition saying that they don't want him to have this knighthood. A petition demanding that Tony Blair be stripped of his knighthood reached its goal of 1 million signatures on Friday. The petition, set up by former soldier Angus Scott at New Year, claims that the former Labour Prime Minister had been the cause of irreparable damage to the constitution of the United Kingdom and the very fabric of the nation's society. Sir Tony had been made a knight companion of the most noble order of the Garter, the most senior form of knighthood, which has been bestowed upon all bar one of his predecessors in the Queen's reign. The petition, which accuses Sir Tony of being personally responsible for the death of countless civilians and servicemen, hit the 1 million signature benchmark on Friday just after 4:30 p.m. But unlike the New Year's honours list, which is drawn up by the government for the Queen's approval, the Order of the Garter is bestowed as a personal gift by the monarch herself. The Honours Forfeiture Committee, which can remove honours for those involved in scandals, cannot recommend the removal of knighthoods handed out in this way. So, of course, this is their excuse. It's not the government's fault. This is just something that automatically happens. Every prime minister gets made into a knight companion of the most noble order of the Garter. So I guess we just have to hope that the Queen sees this and thinks, well, perhaps we shouldn't be giving Tony this after he was responsible for the death of, I don't know, a million Iraqis. I guess we just don't know how many Iraqis are actually killed during that illegitimate war that was based upon false intelligence claiming that there were weapons of mass destruction over there when there weren't any. But this petition is mainly claiming that he did irreparable damage to the constitution of the United Kingdom. And I really wasn't that involved in politics at the time of Tony Blair. And I'm just wondering, what do you think he means here, Max? What was the damage that Tony Blair did to the constitution, do you think?
Well, there was a lot of indecision over whether or not us going to war in Iraq was actually a legal war or not. And I'm not entirely sure of the details, but I believe that there has been an allegation that there was an instruction from the highest level when paperwork was distributed mentioned that there were concerns that the declaration of war might be illegal, that where the instruction in this email was that once the email had been read, then the it must have been a letter. Once the letter had been read, that the letter should then be burned so that nobody else could know its contents. And so a number of people have spoken up. I think the minister concerned in this was Chris Hoon. I might be mistaken, but I believe he has expressed his concern about, you know, the fact that this is alleged to have happened. And there was obviously a dossier of intelligence information that was generated by the security services, and it was alleged this dossier contained information that was known at the time to be untrue and that was just used effectively to sell the idea of us going to war with Iraq. And it's alleged that Tony Blair was well aware of the fact that there were no weapons of mass destruction and wanted to go to war in order to win brownie points with the president of the United States at the time, George W. Bush. You know, as I say, I'm not sure exactly of the facts, so how true all of this is, I don't know. But the fact of the matter is that Tony Blair has become one of the least popular ex-prime ministers since he was unseated as prime minister. Most prime ministers, generally speaking, when they while they're in retirement, generally tend to have their reputations elevated, because people looking back on past times generally tend to have a fairly positive outlook, and so tend to remember the good things that somebody did and not the bad things that they did. And so most ex-prime ministers are actually more popular as ex-prime ministers than they ever were as prime ministers, but that doesn't appear to be the case with Tony Blair. And I have seen allegations made that the reason why it's taken so long for Tony Blair to be given a knighthood is as a result of a dislike of him, a personal dislike of him by the Queen. And again, how true that is, nobody really knows, because you would have to know the inner thoughts of the Queen before you could make any firm pronouncements on that basis. But there does seem to have been a fairly long delay between Tony Blair leaving the prime ministership and him being given this honour. You know, how true it is that that only the Queen can remove the honour, and whether she would want to do that, I don't know. But it's certainly so that a very large number of people, you know, if over 1 million people have signed a petition, that would tend to suggest that there's probably something like 10 times that many people who probably would sign the petition if it was placed in front of them, but haven't got the time or the inclination to go searching for it online. And so at a time when both government and the royal family are
not popular,
short of friends at the moment, you would think that they would want to be as to make that you would want the decisions they make to be as popular as they possibly could be.
Yeah, I mean, it does tend to imply that this is some automatic thing that's happened here, because I can recall hearing that the Queen wasn't particularly enamoured with Tony Blair. So this is just an automatic thing that they get recommended as prime minister. But I also think that with these petitions, it's usually so that this gets debated in Parliament. So they would have to debate this in Parliament, and then we'll see what today's politicians really think of Tony Blair. I seem to remember at the time there was somebody that spoke up about the dodgy dossier, and he ended up dying in suspicious circumstances. He went for a walk in Scotland, and I forget his name, but there was an investigation into that, and that was very serious at the time. George Galloway spoke up about this illegitimate war, and he did very well at the time, speaking up and saying, well, Saddam Hussein doesn't actually have these weapons. Up until that point, the general public, I think, they'd quite liked Tony Blair, and he hitched a ride on the Britpop phenomenon as well, and you had Oasis and Blur, and they were seen at number 10 Downing Street, and it was all seen as it was now going to be a big change from the Thatcher years and the Conservative years, and everything was going to be really good. And then he took us into this war, and he also changed the immigration policy. And I believe we had Jack Straw, who said that they wanted to bring in as many immigrants as possible to rub the right's nose in it, I think was the phrase that he used. So he did a lot of damage to the country as far as immigration is concerned, and did a lot of damage to Iraq as well. And then with the height of hypocrisy, they made him the Middle East envoy for peace after he had basically turned the Middle East into a war zone. I mean, that was just incredible that they gave him that title after he left. And now he's popped up again, hasn't he? Now he's an expert on pandemics and COVID-19. And he's turned up in a sort of a similar role to Bill Gates, talking about vaccines and where we need to go with Corona. So I don't know what's going to happen with this. I think they may well debate this in Parliament. And as I say, it will be interesting to see what the politicians think of it. Keir Starmer appears to approve of this. But of course, he was Labour. But I should imagine a lot of Labour supporters are against this, because they were against the war in Iraq as well. There were a million people that marched against this war. It's not like everybody was behind it. Everybody was against it. And yet he still took us into that war. I mean, it's scandalous. And I mean, it could be said that it was because of that war in Iraq that we ended up with ISIS. And that is basically what happened. Once there was a power vacuum in Iraq, the Islamic State moved in there to take over that power vacuum. Of course, the Islamic State, we know, have had help from America to go into Syria. But it was the fact that there was this power vacuum there that started that. And he's responsible for a lot of ills in the world today. And again, yeah, it's just it's another black mark, isn't it, against the monarchy if they go along with this. Have you got any other thoughts?
I would say that that one of the lessons to learn from this is that you shouldn't automatically award honours to people who've just occupied a particular position, irrespective of whether or not they're actually believed to have done a good job or not, because you know, it is fairly obvious that a very large number of people, I mean, even people within the Labour Party, a very considerable number of people within the Labour Party, dislike Tony Blair to a considerable degree. And for him to be honoured in this way is just foolish in my view. And it's, heaven forbid if anybody was to suggest building a statue to Tony Blair, because I would think that statue would probably go the same way as the Edward Colston statue in The Fullness of Time. And as you say, the Queen and the royal family with the honours system and the government, insofar as they've got influence over the honours system, they need to think very carefully about who they bestow honours upon. And so don't, first of all, create these kind of problems where they give an honour automatically to somebody who's deeply unpopular, but so that they don't give honours away in such a way that it devalues the honour and makes the honour effectively worthless.
Well, you brought up Edward Colston there, and this is another subject that we hadn't actually planned on bringing into the podcast. But I tell you, there's just so much news happening in Britain over the last week. And the people that actually tore down the Edward Colston statue, they were found not guilty by a jury. Even though it's quite clear they were guilty, of vandalism against public property, and yet the jury seemed to decide that because Edward Colston was a nasty person by today's standards, it was okay to destroy his statue. And so the actual point of law didn't even come into it. It was just all about feelings. And apparently it has been appealed, this decision. But I mean, that's a shocking decision. And we've also had Ghislaine Maxwell found guilty last week. And again, this involves the royal family. This involves Prince Edward and the allegations against him by Virginia. I've got Edward written here. Prince Andrew. I get confused between them all. And Virginia Jeffrey's accusations against him. But of course, Virginia Jeffrey at the time was 17, and the legal age for consent in Britain is 16. So whatever they did was completely legal, unless he forced himself upon her. And I find it very, very hard to believe that a prince has to force himself upon anyone. I mean, most teenage girls 30 years ago, perhaps not today, but most teenage girls 30 years ago, they would have dreamt of having a prince interested in them, sleeping with a prince. I mean, all women want to go for the most alpha male that they can get. And you don't get much more alpha than royalty. And Ghislaine Maxwell, I really do think she thought she wasn't doing anything wrong. These girls that she was procuring prostitutes for the rich and famous, basically, most of the time. And it does look like there were some there that were 14 or 15. And I dare say that they would have come across as if they were experienced in these sorts of things. And I think she would have thought that she was putting them in touch with the rich and famous. And indeed, some of the so-called victims making these allegations, they now have singing careers, they now have acting careers. And you just think, well, where did they make those contacts to get that singing career or to get that acting career? And I would guess that they made those contacts through Jeffrey Epstein. I mean, some of the women that made these accusations, they went back out to his island hundreds of times, or back out to his house in New York many, many, many times. They were paid. One of them was going on plane trips and was massaging Bill Clinton's feet, worked for Epstein for many years. And it's similar to this accusation that was made against Harvey Weinstein. And it was actually Harvey Weinstein's girlfriend. She claimed she was raped, and then she was his girlfriend for the next 10 years. And he put her in all his movies. And yet he was found guilty of raping her. And if somebody is raped, they're not going to go back they're not going to go back a second time, are they? This is what I don't get. So I do have slight sympathy for her, because I think she saw it that she was just procuring prostitutes for the rich and famous, and she's been found guilty of it. Of course, the other side to all of this is that it was a honey trap operation. Jeffrey Epstein had links, obviously Ghislaine Maxwell had links to her father, and he had links to the Mossad. And there are allegations that all of this was about getting incriminating evidence on the rich and famous and politicians with these young girls, so that information could then be used to lean on these people to get them to make decisions favourable to Israel through the Mossad. So there's those connections as well. But none of those actually came into the trial. None of that was talked about by the mainstream media. And it does seem to me that that's what she was doing, procuring prostitutes for the rich and famous. Some of them were underage, not very underage. I mean, you're talking, there's some countries in the world where the age of consent is 14. I'm not sure that there was anyone under the age of 14 that was alleging that this had actually gone on. And in Britain, the age is 16. So Prince Andrew, by British law, he hasn't done anything wrong. And I think Ghislaine Maxwell thinks that she hasn't done anything wrong. And I dare say a lot of the rich and famous do, but they won't say that in the mainstream media. They will condemn her. But I think they're all at this. I mean, we've all heard of the casting couch, the music industry, the acting industry, Hollywood. It's all absolutely degenerate. And these pop stars and these actors and actresses that you see that make it into these movies, I mean, I don't know for certain, but I have a suspicion that they all got there through the casting couch, the majority of them. And if they've got a chance to get a record deal or to be in a movie, if they sleep with the producer, then they're very likely to do that. And I think what's going on now, particularly with Harvey Weinstein, is that they then claim that it was actually rape now because of that, basically. And it's a financial transaction. Any thoughts on that, Max?
Well, what I would say is that as far as Prince Andrew is concerned, I think he's been sort of fairly unlucky in all of this, in that Virginia Roberts was over the age of 17 when she was first introduced to him, when he is alleged to have had sex with her in London. So, you know, she would have been above the age of sexual consent at that point. And so therefore there shouldn't be, you know, it might be regarded as immoral that he had sex with her, but it wouldn't be regarded as illegal. But the second occasion where he is alleged to have had sex with her was at a location in New York, which has an age of sexual consent of 18. And at that particular date, she was, I think, 17 years and 8 months old. So, you know, for want of 4 months there, Prince Andrew could be found guilty if she can prove to a court that he had sex with her. He could be found guilty of having underage sex. It's also sort of ironic that the house that Jeffrey Epstein had in New York is quite close to the Hudson River, and had it been situated perhaps about 1.5 kilometers to the west, then he would have been in New Jersey instead of being in New York, in which case that wouldn't have been below the age of sexual consent, because the age of sexual consent in New Jersey is 17. And if you look at the United States of America, there are some states where the age of sexual consent is 16, some states where it's 17, some states where it's 18. And so you can very inadvertently, if you just happen to be on the wrong side of a state border, you can find yourself being charged with having sex with somebody who's underage, quite sort of inadvertently. And who's to say that that Andrew was aware of her precise age on those particular occasions in any event? The other thing which I think has rebounded quite sort of unfortunately for Prince Andrew is the fact that when in 2009, when Virginia Roberts sued Jeffrey Epstein, she mentioned that she had in her court submissions that she had been forced to have sex with what does it say here, required to be sexually exploited by defendants, adult male peers including royalty, politicians, academics, businessmen and other professional acquaintances. And so by mention of the word royalty there, Prince Andrew's defense lawyers have said that, you know, he was specifically a party to that particular agreement. In the agreement that was eventually made, the out-of-court settlement between Virginia Roberts and Jeffrey Epstein, the term other potential defendants was mentioned. And again, Andrew's defense lawyers have said that, you know, he is obviously one of the other potential defendants. But apparently there is also a passage in that particular out-of-court settlement document where it mentions that only Virginia Roberts and Jeffrey Epstein are able to invoke that settlement in a court of law. And so because Prince Andrew isn't actually a party to that agreement, but albeit that he is referred to within the agreement, then the judge that's hearing Virginia Jeffrey, as she's now called, Virginia Roberts' action against Prince Andrew, who appears to be inclined to dismiss Andrew's him being a party to that agreement, and so therefore Virginia Jeffrey being unable to take action against him a second time. And so that there are these unfortunate technicalities, you know, the Virginia Jeffrey's age just being 4 months short of the legal age of consent in New York, the house in which it's alleged that Prince Andrew had sex with her being only like only 1.5 kilometers the wrong side of the border with New Jersey, and the unfortunate phrasing of these of this agreement. So all those things have contributed. It's four kind of unlucky things there that have contributed to Prince Andrew being embroiled in all of this. It is a rum affair, and it just goes to demonstrate really all of this, you know, with Ghislaine Maxwell and, you know, the history of her father, Robert Maxwell, and the fact that he was a crook, the fact that he was an agent for the Mossad, the fact that he was then given a state burial by the Israelis and he's buried standing upright in the Mount of Olives. You know, all of these things together with Jeffrey Epstein and Jeffrey Epstein's alleged links to Mossad as well. It's the whole issue stinks, really, doesn't it? And it's just very unfortunate for the people who were the marks, the people who were being set up so that they could be blackmailed in future. And it's just a symptom of the immoral society in which we have that our society has become in recent years.
I should imagine that those girls, they didn't tell their honest, they weren't honest about their age anyway. I should imagine they said that they were 16 or 17. I mean, girls do pretend to be older. Everybody pretends to be older when they're younger, especially if they can get away with looking older. And it's not like these girls were looking like they were very young. I mean, you see that picture of Virginia Jeffrey with Prince Andrew, and she looks 18, 19. I can remember when I was at school and there were girls that were going out with older boys, and they wanted to go out with older boys. So I don't think that Prince Andrew would have known that she was underage. And these allegations that they've made, they've said that that Ghislaine Maxwell sort of took advantage of them and they looked up to her and all of this. And you just think, well what did they think this older woman was taking an interest in them for when this older woman was meeting them when they were training to be masseurs and paying them to go and massage Jeffrey Epstein? I mean, what do they think she was doing? And I dare say Ghislaine Maxwell thought, well, I'm helping these girls out. I'm giving them a lift up. I'm giving them an introduction to the rich and famous. And as I say, some of them have gone on to have singing careers. I think one of them was actually met at a singing camp where she went to a singing camp. And again, the casting couch does come into this. And of course, it's wrong. But that is just the way it is. And I'm sure that these girls were asked, do you want to go in to, here's the money, do you want to go in and see Jeffrey Epstein? I mean, what did they think they were getting paid this large amount of money for? It's just, I don't know, the whole thing stinks, really. I'm sure if they actually were raped, then it was absolutely awful. But if you're talking in situations where people have been paid a large amount of money, far more than they would have just been paid for a massage. And they said that they were being paid £30 an hour 30 years ago, which is £200 or £300 an hour today. So, and you're not paid £200 or £300 an hour just to go in and massage somebody's shoulders. That's not what was going on here. So I find it hard to believe that these girls were just completely naive and innocent, and suddenly Jeffrey Epstein dropped his towel and they just froze and they didn't scream out or anything when he forced himself on them. And they then went back there the next week and again for the next 3 or 4 years and travelled in a plane with him. It doesn't add up. And I think there's been all this media pressure to find her guilty of this. I think she's been made a scapegoat, really. But it's all very bizarre. I mean, the way that Jeffrey Epstein himself was sort of thrown under the bus when he was tight in there with Mossad, and the way that she has been as well, being the daughter of Jeffrey Maxwell, and as you were saying, that he was the way that he was buried on the Mount of Olives and given this funeral in Israel, it doesn't add up that she's suddenly being hung out to dry over this. And another thing that doesn't really fit in to me is, if there was all this blackmail that was going on and they were being caught in these compromising positions, wouldn't somebody have said, well, don't go to Jeffrey Epstein's parties because you'll end up being leaned upon to do something for them, and he'll have this incriminating evidence on you? Because, I mean, this was going on for years and all the rich and famous were there. So you would think if that they were then leaned on or blackmailed, that they would have stopped going and that they would have told their friends to stop going. But that doesn't seem to have happened. So it's all very confusing to me. I think there's lots there that we don't actually know about.
Well, I think two things there that occur to me. One is that success in the modern day world, in the world of sport, requires you to have a degree of skill. In the world of entertainment, doesn't necessarily require you to be particularly talented. You know, I would think there probably are 10 times as many people who are talented as singers and musicians as there are opportunities for people to become high earning singers and musicians, and so it's the opportunity that is the thing that is valued, and so if you're offered the opportunity to become a famous singer or a famous actor and become well paid and earn millions, then and you are just one of the people who are that there are 10 times too many of, then you're going to jump at being given that opportunity. The other thing is that there are so many incongruous things that are taking place here. It's difficult to sort of get to the nub of things, but one of the most incongruous things that's happened is that since the conviction of Ghislaine Maxwell, this chap has come forward who was a member of the jury that found her guilty, and who has now confessed that he had been a victim of sexual abuse when he was a child. And apparently he mentioned this during the jury's deliberations. And apparently two other members of the jury then also said that, yes, that they were victims of sexual exploitation when they were children as well. And yet one of the questions that was asked during in the jury selection questionnaire was, you know, have you been, or has anybody, any member of your family, been a victim of child sexual abuse? And so all three of these people presumably answered no, because otherwise they would have been selected out by Ghislaine Maxwell's defence lawyers. But this one particular chap says that he doesn't remember the question. But then apparently when his questionnaire has been examined, it's been found that he said no, he hadn't been on the questionnaire. He hadn't been a victim of sexual abuse in the past. And so therefore, now we've got Ghislaine Maxwell's defence lawyers claiming that there was a mistrial and claiming that the trial would have to be held all over again. And so, again, this is another sort of incongruous development, which is the sort of thing that might happen if somebody was trying to manipulate the legal system in the United States in order to eventually get Ghislaine Maxwell off. I don't know whether anybody had approached any of the members of the jury with a view to offering them large amounts of money to perjure themselves in order to get the trial declared to be a mistrial. And, you know, when you consider the number of rich and famous people that have presumably been compromised to some extent by the honeypot operation that was alleged to have been operated, it's quite possible that somebody, you know, may well have done that.
Now, what would be the point of it, though? I mean, if it's a mistrial, then it just has to be heard again. It would just have to be done all over again. So what would be the benefit in that happening? It would just drag proceedings out. But at the same time, I guess it would be one way of getting that judgment overturned. And then maybe in the next one, you could get one of your own guys on the jury, I guess. Because I don't really see how it would be of benefit to her. But yeah, I've heard that they're calling for a mistrial. Again, it really just shows the failure that we have with our legal system at the moment, to be honest. Over in Britain, with this Bristol decision, which found that the people pulling down the Edward Colston statue were not guilty, and now with the possibility of a mistrial over there in America, there's also this armored Arbery character who was running onto a construction site, and it looked like he was casing the joint up looking to find things to steal, and he was asked to stop and he refused to stop, and he ran, and an ex-police officer gave chase and they ended up shooting him in self-defense, and they've just been found guilty of manslaughter. Life, all these decisions that are being made by juries that are being based on emotion rather than on the facts of the case. And it keeps happening, basically. And I think that could have been what happened here. Emotions rather than the facts of the case, and media manipulation. I guess we should count ourselves lucky that Kyle Rittenhouse wasn't found guilty after all the media manipulation that went on there. But yes, we'll keep an eye on this. I think it's a story that's not gone away yet, particularly the Prince Andrew part of it. Well, shall we get into our Greatest Britons then, Max?
Yes, let's do that.
Okay, well, this week we have a new Greatest Briton, and this one was suggested to us by Michael Woodbridge. And you will find an Albion Insights interview with Michael Woodbridge. He's on at radioalbion.com. He's a long-time nationalist, a veteran nationalist, I guess you could say. And there's a very interesting interview with him when he was in prison behind the Iron Curtain, which makes for good listening. And he suggested that we do this character as one of our greatest Britons, and he's provided me with a couple of books on the man himself, and I've also taken some notes from Wikipedia. And the greatest Briton for this week is Lord Leverhulme, William Hesketh Lever, 1st Viscount Leverhulme, of Unilever fame, the big corporation that is now called Unilever. Originally, that was started off by him. He was born 19th of September 1851, and he died the 7th of May 1925. He was an English industrialist, a great philanthropist, as we will hear, and a politician. Having been educated at a small private school until the age of 9, then at church schools until he was 15, which is a somewhat privileged education for that time, he then started work at his father's wholesale grocery business in Bolton. And I'll just stop there, because from my notes from this book, I found something quite interesting about being a greengrocer. It was quite an important trade at the time, and you had apprentices. And if you were an apprentice in 1823, you got food and lodging and medicine, and that was it. You got no wages, and the apprenticeship would last 2 or 3 years, and it was expected that your family or your friends would help you out with everything else. And then once you were a grocer, you could expect to earn quite a bit of money. This is one grocer in 1851. This is actually Lord Leverhulme's father in 1851. In his household, there was the husband, the wife, 5 daughters, a journeyman grocer, 2 apprentice grocers, and 3 servants, a cook, a housemaid, and a nurse. So one greengrocer could expect to pay for a journeyman grocer, 2 apprentice grocers, and have 3 servants for his 5 daughters. And you compare that to what a shopkeeper earns today. Nowhere near that. So I guess the economy must have been doing a lot better back then than it is today. Is there anything on that you want to comment on, Max?
No, I'd need to think about that a bit more before I had anything significant to say, I think.
Well, you think, I mean, a greengrocer could afford to have 3 servants living in his house. So obviously there was more money available to go around back then. And also we think of the upper class having servants, and yet we don't think of being a greengrocer as being upper class. Well, following an apprenticeship and a series of appointments in the family business, which he successfully expanded, William began manufacturing Sunlight soap, building a substantial business empire with many well-known brands such as Lux and Lifebuoy. Also Vim as well. That's one of the ones that I recognise that's still around today. In 1886, together with his brother James, he established Lever Brothers, which was one of the first companies to manufacture soap from vegetable oils, and which is now a part of the Anglo-Dutch transnational business Unilever. In 1887, he built an entire village for his workers as he sought to put his views on moral capitalism into action, in a similar way to George Stephenson, the father of railways, who also believed that the profits should be shared among the workers and used to raise their standard of living. William believed that a happy and healthy worker was a good worker, and the village that he built became known as Port Sunlight, and we'll have a look at that in detail when we get there. After this, he became the victim of a media conspiracy against him, which he managed to defeat, before briefly sitting as a Liberal MP for Wirral and later as Lord Leverhulme in the House of Lords as a peer. He was an advocate for the expansion of the British Empire, particularly in Africa and Asia, which supplied palm oil, which is a key ingredient in Lever's soap product line. And his firm has recently been smeared through association with the alleged forced labour and atrocities that supposedly took place in the Belgian Congo in 1911. And most of those accusations actually come from a book that was written by a communist just in the last 20 years. There were accusations back then of some bad things that happened, but nowhere near the accusations that are being made today. And we have a podcast on this at radioalbion.com. That, Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson did a whole episode on the hoax, propaganda, porn that was this allegations about the Belgian Congo. And in our series that we're beginning today, we will be mainly taking a look at the paternalistic village that he built for his workers and the media conspiracy against him, and also his later life when he bought two islands in Scotland and tried to do the same there. But we will start with a look at his early life. Do you want to make any comments on that, Max?
Just to say that the approach that Lord Leverhulme had was in line with other benevolent capitalists that existed at the time. And there were, I think we've mentioned in previous episodes of Bourneville and the way in which the Cadbury family created Bourneville as a garden city. This was the time of the Garden City movement, which was started in 1898 by Ebenezer Howard, which resulted in the building of Letchworth, Welling Garden City, and Brentham Garden suburbs, all of which were garden cities. And so there is this movement at that time where there are amongst the capitalists that were active in Britain at the time, there were people who had a very benevolent attitude towards their workers and who appreciated that good work is done by people that are happy, and that it is the business of an entrepreneur to make sure that the people that work in their business are happy and fulfilled and share in the profits that are generated.
Yeah, it's a socialist, but it's also nationalist as well. I mean, today it's all unions and it's making out that the guys at the top are the bad guys, and there's class war, and the lower classes should be against the upper classes. And yet here we have an example of somebody who worked his way up to the upper class, and he did all he could for his workers, building them villages, making them look really good, and trying to do everything that he could for his people. And he tried to export that as well for the Africans in the Congo. You know, he built a village there for them. He built everything that he'd actually built in Britain for them, but they weren't interested in it. It didn't work there. And we'll get to that later on. And the word I was trying to think of that I couldn't think of was atrocity propaganda. That's what the books about the Belgian Congo are now. They are atrocity propaganda or atrocity porn. Did you want to add anything else there, Max?
Well, just that if anybody's interested, there is a village in the middle of Bedfordshire called Stewartby, and there was I think it was called the Stewartby Brick Company that existed there and in that vicinity of Bedfordshire, where there are deep supplies of clay that can be used to make bricks. There were lots of brickworks in that area. But Stewartby was, again, not exactly a garden city, but a garden village. And if you get the opportunity just of taking a short diversion off the M1 as you're travelling through Bedfordshire, you can go to Stewartby. And when you get to Stewartby, you recognise it instantly, because it's like driving into Trumpton. You know, it looks like a life-sized toy village, complete with its own post office and shops and things of this sort. But every house is built to a high standard. Every house stands in its own garden, and the garden's set back from the road so that there's plenty of room for children to play, and that people have got plenty of room in their gardens so that they can cultivate their gardens and grow vegetables if they want to in their back gardens or whatever. But it's when you drive into Stewartby for the first time, you're just amazed, because it's just, as I say, like driving into a life-sized toy village.
And when you're working at a good place with a good employer, you have a good sense of camaraderie with the team that you're working with, and you do make good friends there. And it does make sense to sort of all be living together and to look after these people. And it was actually a visit to Port Sunlight that actually prompted Michael to recommend that we actually looked into this. He's been to visit the place. It's still open there today. There are still people that live there. There's an art museum that Lever built there. There's churches there. There's all sorts of stuff there. Let's get into his early life then. William Lever was born on 19th of September 1851 in Bolton, Lancashire, England. He was the eldest son and the seventh child born to James Lever. I guess maybe Lever is the British pronunciation of that word, but I used to work for one of these companies and I'm sure they referred to it as Unilever. So I'll refer to him as Lever. He was the seventh child born to James Lever, 1809 to 1897, a grocer, and Eliza Hesketh, a daughter of a cotton mill manager. From age 6 to age 9, William attended a small private school run not far from the Lever family home. At the age of 9, he was sent to another of Bolton's private schools before finishing his formal education at Bolton Church Institute from 1864 to 1867. Not a particularly bright scholar, he was nevertheless keen to acquire academic learning. His mother wanted him to enter the learned professions, ostensibly medicine, and William himself was very interested in becoming an architect. And we can also see that in the buildings at Port Sunlight. And no house is built the same as another. And he actually brought in dozens of different architects to actually work on it. His father, however, had other somewhat less erudite plans for his eldest son. And thus, not long after his 15th birthday, he started work in the family grocery business. In the celebrated Victorian manner, the boss's son was initially, at least, shown no preferential treatment, being required to sweep the floor and tidy up before the staff arrived. And I'll just stop there again. I mean, this reminds me of what Professor Edward Dutton has said about the schooling that the upper classes used to have, where they were treated very badly at school, so that they had some solidarity with the working classes. And I think there was this feeling back then that if you were well off or if you were the boss, then you had to treat your son or the people beneath you. You had to get them to have some solidarity with the others so they didn't see that they were above everybody else or were abusive to anyone else. I guess this is a commendable thing.
And this used to be a principle also within the police force. If you joined the police years ago, you had to join as a police constable. And I think you had to do something like 2 years service as a police constable before you could be considered for any higher promotions. And this then ensured that even people who joined the police force from wealthy backgrounds had a 2 year grounding in what it's like to be a policeman on the beat before they were placed in a position where they would have to make decisions that would affect the lives and safety of other men and women.
I think it's a very good idea. You know, start your way at the bottom so you understand it all. Other tasks included various practical assignments, more to do with the fundamentals of the wholesale grocery trade, almost certainly designed to prepare the youth for management in later years. His remuneration was a shilling a week all found, which meant that his board and lodgings were provided, making the financial aspect of the contract more or less pocket money. Well, that's still more than they were getting 50 years earlier. 50 years earlier, they were just getting board and lodging. They didn't get that shilling a week extra. Your friends and your family had to provide that. At some stage, William was moved to the administration department where he learned about and subsequently reorganized the firm's accounting and bookkeeping systems. Perhaps in order to escape the shackles of his father's close supervision, he eventually petitioned to take the place of a retiring sales representative. In those days, being a rep meant a great deal of traveling by horse and carriage and spending nights away from home, as well as a measure of independence and some leeway in making decisions and brokering deals with the canny retailers on his route. And this is interesting. He must have really enjoyed this, actually, because later years, he went on a holiday by horse and carriage with a specifically built carriage, and he just spent the whole summer travelling around Dorset and Devon, around the byways, sort of pretty much living the life of a gypsy, but with servants on board as well. Before the time when people used to go away by motor car with caravan, he did it by horse and carriage.
And what you've just presented there actually answers a question that you posed to me a bit earlier on, which is about the income that a greengrocer would have. it appears that rather than just having one greengrocer shop and being a proprietor of a greengrocer shop, that Lord Leverholm's father was the proprietor of a wholesale greengrocer's business where they were that they were selling their produce on to other greengrocers. So he would have then had a large number of employees and would be making more money than the owner of a local greengrocer corner shop, for example.
And they also had more products as well. I mean, they were doing soap and all sorts of stuff, and they were manufacturing it themselves. And I think shops used to have their own concoctions. Like chemists used to have their own medicines that they would get made up, and they were unique to that shop, the same as a tobacconist will have unique types of tobacco that used to be only available from that shop. And it wasn't just tobacconists and chemists. So I think it was greengrocers and all the sort of shops we used to have. They used to say that the English are a nation of shopkeepers, didn't they? So
it was something
we used to pride ourselves on. The Lever family were Congregationalists, and James Lever, a teetotaler and a non-smoker, applied its principles in his business life as well as in his personal life. In accordance with nonconformist tenets, the Lever family held frequent Bible readings at home and were regular worshippers at the local chapel. Thus, William's circle of friends tended to compromise children of similar backgrounds and beliefs. Among these was Elizabeth Ellen Hulme, whose family also resided on Wood Street. In the tradition of the 19th century well-to-do middle classes, William paid court to Elizabeth over several years, and when the financial circumstances allowed, he formally proposed marriage, and on the 17th of April 1874, after a two-year engagement, they were married. And that's where the Hulme part of his name actually comes from. And so I guess this was almost like an arranged marriage. I guess this was the end of the sort of arranged marriage era. You sort of knew who you were going to marry when you were young, if you had rich parents, wealthy parents. In 1879, the Lever family business acquired a failing wholesale grocer in Wigan, affording young William an opportunity to prove his ability as a quasi-autonomous administrator. The expanded activity necessitated a search for new suppliers, taking William to Ireland, France, and other parts of Europe, appointing local agents to safeguard the firm's interests. At this time, his flair for advertising and branding began to emerge, as he successfully differentiated the Lever brand from generic commodities. By the end of 1879, the business's prospects were good enough to convince William and Elizabeth to invest in a new home in Bolton, and by 1881, the expanding Wigan business warranted the commissioning of new premises. Lever and Company was expanding steadily. And he was a bit of a genius with advertising. He ended up purchasing lots of paintings, really, really good paintings. And then he would stick the brand, the Sunlight Soap, which was the brand name that he would use. He would then stick that on the painting. And some of the listeners may have seen these old advertisements, really nice, nicely painted, because they're actually painted by expert artists. And he would buy the painting, and of course the painting didn't have a copyright on it, and then he would stick the advert of the company on it. There was one that actually complained about that, but it's quite indicative of the time when you actually see the adverts that he put up there. I'm sure listeners will recognise them and get nostalgic for them. I don't know if there are any comments on any of that, Max?
Well, that sounds to me as if he was using sound business sense there in making his product associated with good quality paintings that presumably would have depicted scenes or depicted objects or whatever that were consistent with the brand image that he was trying to create. And so it's an early use of sophisticated marketing techniques.
Yeah, cleanliness, purity, beauty, that sort of thing he was trying to get across, I think. In 1884, having developed Lever and Company to a point where it was virtually self-governing, William resolved to capture a large share of the international soap trade. In essence, he planned to manufacture and market a range of high-quality, price-differentiated products using a strategy based upon his experiences with butter and other commodity products. There you go, also selling butter at the grocers, not just vegetables. Thus, instead of selling soap by weight, he had it cut into small, manageable tablets which were individually wrapped. The 1875 Trademark Registration Act protected trade names from counterfeiters and imitators, and this opened the way for brand name recognition and consumer loyalty. Within 12 months, Lever had registered a series of trademarks, among them Sunlight, a house style that was later applied to a range of household soaps differentiated mainly by colour, pale, mottled and brown, with a fourth variant presented as a product that was especially formulated for washing clothes. This Sunlight self-washer soap was widely advertised using billboards and posters located at public places throughout northern England. And yeah, I think a lot of this was laundry. I mean, I guess we don't think of soap as actually being used for laundry now. We think of laundry detergent. But back yeah. then, it was all sorts of cleaning products, basically.
But use of the term sunlight as well. It's what people when people think about washing on a washing line, you imagine going out and it being a sunny day and the sun shining through the line of sparkling clean washing, and it will having a nice fresh smell. So it sort of conjures up all those sort of evocative thoughts, doesn't it? The word sunlight.
Yeah, it's exactly what he was trying to get across, I think, there, Max.
Absolutely.
At that time, Lever had to rely for supplies on soap boilers, independent firms that specialised in producing soap to order, who were then expected to work to his proprietary formula. But the reliability of these suppliers was, however, apparently questionable, as variations in the end product gave rise to complaints about the effectiveness and even the smell of self-washer. I think in some cases, if it wasn't absolutely fresh, the outside of it would start to go rancid, which did cause a problem. But it was such good soap that there were people that refused to use anything else, and they would just scrape this rancid stuff off the top of it. I guess he was one of the first to think of putting it all in these bars and wrapping them up separately instead of just selling it by the chunks. And you can't imagine buying soap by the pound at the greengrocer's. After much consideration, William began to consider the possibility of taking control of the manufacture and thus the quality of Sunlight soaps. He had discovered a small producer based in Warrington that badly needed to increase its output in order to become profitable, and although Lever could probably have solved its problem through placing orders for most of his soap, he clearly wanted to take complete control. Having persuaded his father and younger brother that it would be a beneficial strategy, William raised sufficient capital for the takeover to take place, and in August 1885, Lever and Company, wholesale grocers, added soap manufacturing to its range of activities. The success of the Sunlight brand, especially after Lever assumed full responsibility for the product's quality, was exceptional. So much so that by the end of 1887, it had become impossible to squeeze any more capacity from the Warrington plant. Having failed to either extend the site or find more space in the areas, Lever eventually decided to move the whole manufacturing facility to an 11-acre greenfield site near Birkenhead. Of course, this is when the possibility arises to start building a village around it. In 1887, Lever bought 56 acres of land on the Wirral in Cheshire between the River Mersey and the railway line at Bebbington, and this site became Port Sunlight, where he built his works and a model village to house its employees. Now, a model village is a type of mostly self-contained community built from the late 18th century onwards by landowners and business magnates to house their workers. Although the villages are located close to the workplace, they are generally physically separated from them and often consist of relatively high quality housing with integrated community amenities and attractive physical environments. Model is used in the sense of an ideal to which other developments could aspire. Imagine that, your boss today building you a house, and not just any house, but the best house, because they wanted to compete amongst themselves to show who was the most looking after their workers. And it's so different from today, when you have zero-hour contracts and temping companies. And back then, you were expected to work for the company for life, and the company was expected to look after you and give you surroundings which would improve your health, even to give you beautiful surroundings to live in. Rather than
and that description you've just given exactly matches the description really that I gave of Stuart B in Bedfordshire, which is just like that. And although the term model is intended to be interpreted as the ideal village, it also does create a kind of an aesthetic which makes it appear as though you're entering a full-sized model or a toy village, effectively, because it's been constructed in the way that somebody would construct an ideal toy village. So the word model there has in my view, two meanings as far as the term is concerned, model village.
Well, I guess they were sort of competing against one another to see who could build the best, and also trying to sort of put pressure on the government. You know, if we can build houses like this for our workers, why can you not build houses like that for everyone, for the people that aren't working for these big companies? Why not make council houses like that? As the Industrial Revolution took hold, industrialists who built factories in rural locations provided housing for workers clustered around the workplace. An early example of an industrial model village was New Lanark, built by Robert Owen. Philanthropic coal owners provided decent accommodation for miners from the early 19th century, and Earl Fitzwilliam, a paternalistic colliery owner, provided houses near his coal pits in Elsicar near Barnsley that were of a class superior in size and arrangement, and inconveniences attached to those of working classes. They had four rooms each and a pantry, and outside a small garden and a pigsty. Quaker industrialists George Cadbury and Rowntree's built model villages by their factories. Cadbury built Bourneville between 1898 and 1905, and a second phase from 1914, and New Earswick was built in 1902 for Rowntree's. William Lever's Port Sunlight had a village green, and its houses espoused an idealised rural vernacular style. And it really does sound quite impressive, this village, when we get into it. We'll get into that next week, though. Do you want to add anything to this, Max? Any thoughts on these various examples here, these philanthropic business owners?
Well, just that you're absolutely right in terms of comparing the motivations of those patriotic capitalists during that period of time when there was when the Garden City movement was springing up, and the very quaint and idealistic and idealized proportions of the villages that they created, and what a wonderful development that was. And it did go on to inspire, you know, in the early post-war period during the 1950s, it did inspire lots of local councils to build what were actually quite generous council properties in those days, with large gardens, larger houses, with the intention of housing large families. It's just a pity, really, that then economic pressures caused governments in later decades to then build high-rise blocks and things of that sort, which have all the sort of attendant problems that we're all pretty familiar with that afflict high-rise blocks of flats. It's just a pity that the Garden City movement and the council house building programs that were spawned by that Garden City movement didn't maintain their standards into the modern time.
I find it interesting that they had a pigsty there. They obviously had enough of a garden so you could grow your own vegetables, and you had enough room there for your animals as well. So you were sort of self-contained and self-sufficient. You compare that to the so-called philanthropists today, George Soros and I've forgotten his name, Bill Gates. I mean, there are supposed philanthropists today. Where are the villages that Bill Gates has built for his Windows staff? What has George Soros done apart from try to subvert entire countries? And the word philanthropist today, it's sort of a more associated with these NGOs that get used to subvert countries. I mean, the Clintons are seen as philanthropists. You know, the Clinton charity. We don't seem to have any great philanthropists like this anymore. And that coincides with the loss of patriotism and nationalism as well. I mean, as we heard at the beginning of this, William Leverholm was a big supporter of the British Empire. He was very conscious of his ethnicity and of his people, and he wanted to do the best for them. Well, shall we leave that there then, Max, and get into more of this next week, do you think?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay, well, thank you very much for coming on today.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Monday with more Real Britannia for you. And, of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.